time. Good morning. Welcome to Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We're also on Sportsnet Television as well. Show Ali and Nick Ashbourne with you this Monday morning. We are filling in for Blake Murphy, who is getting a well-deserved break before the home stretch. He's back on Thursday. Nick, this is our maiden voyage on TV together, but it's nice to see you in person. It's nice to do this with you again. How's it going after a four-game sweep of the Angels?
It's going well. I don't know if it's going as well for me as the Blue Jays. Like, they're on quite a roll here. We had quite a roll on Jays Talk kind of mid-July into early August, and we're getting back together doing Jays Talk again this weekend. So I think people might be sick of us by Sunday, but for now, it's a fresh combination.
It is. It's funny because I think when we did Jays Talk earlier in, July, thereabouts, a lot of wins and losses mixed in, kind of some mixed results for the Blue Jays. But an August to remember for the Blue Jays so far, 13-9 for the Blue Jays so far this month. And, I mean, since the All-Star break, they're hovering just above 500 on the season. I think a lot of people, Nick, ask where this team was all season. And it's funny, because before we talk about Baden Francis and talk about Kevin Gausman and talk about the Angels series, as a whole, in general, I did want to get your take on this, because I was talking about this last night on Jays Talk, and as to like why the vibes are so different and why they're so good. And I think it's important to make the distinction that good vibes don't necessarily mean the team is now like a World Series or a playoff contender. I think it just, there are more fun storylines to discuss, right? There are young players making the most of their opportunity. We're talking about auditions for 2025. You get the fun stories like Baden Francis taking a no-hitter into the bottom and the top of the ninth inning. So I think that's what it means when it means we talk about good vibes. But I'm curious, when you look at what the Blue Jays have accomplished recently and why they seem to be playing, let's see, a little freer, a little looser, what you see from this team?
I mean, when you ask the question, like, where was this team in April and May? They were at AAA and various other organizations, right? Yeah. Like, this is a totally new ball club, whether it's, Joey Loperfido, Will Wagner, the imports, Bowden Francis, who we're going to talk about. He wasn't with the team for much of the season. Sure, he spent some time in AAA as well. And so you get this influx of young players, and it's some kind of cliche to say it, but they're all immensely motivated. Like, they are trying to find their way at the big league level, prove they belong, and get jobs into the future. And that's a very different proposition than a team of veterans who knows they're kind of stumbling towards missing the playoffs and might just be in a little bit of a sleepwalking sort of mode. And I think that you saw a bit of that in, say June, July. Like, I know these guys are professionals, but at the same time, it is disheartening to say, our playoff chances have fallen to 1.3%, 0.9%. kind of tick down all the way through the middle of the season, and now you've got a group of players who are extremely motivated, and the wins and losses, the wins are coming, but they don't matter that much because these guys are just trying to show what they've got.
This is probably more of Blake's wheelhouse, but I will make the comparison anyways. But I was talking about this yesterday on Jays Talk, the idea that maybe it's much like the Raptors. It's probably a little easier to, it's not like they're making tons of mistakes, but it's probably a little easier to produce when the stakes are a little lower. You know what I mean? I'm not saying that that explains everything. Like, I'm not saying we can say, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is having a great year because there's no pressure. I think he's having a great year because he's Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and because he's absolutely tearing the cover off baseballs, as we continue to see yesterday. But I do wonder, and I only bring up the Raptors because I remember having this conversation about Scotty Barnes, for example, last year. And it's kind of like, how much growth is Scotty Barnes going to do right up until he had the season-ending injury? But how much growth is he going to do when it comes to performing in a no pressure environment? And how good would that be if you don't have a lot of expectations on you? And I kind of wonder if the same probably holds true for a Baden Francis, for example, right? And Baden Francis, the Francis we're seeing now, especially over the last four starts, gosh, he's been amazing, is not the Baden Francis we saw in April. Like, the first start of the season for Baden Francis, if memory serves, Ronel Blanco no-hit the Blue Jays at Minute Park in Houston. And on the other side of that game, Baden Francis got lit up by the Astros in Houston. And now here we are, and it's like we're seeing two different pitchers. And I think he found something in the minors. The fastball command looks phenomenal. He's allowed the splitter to work really well off of that. Like, there are a lot of things that are going right for Baden Francis, but I also do wonder how much of it is he got a little bit of a mental reset, and now he's looking phenomenal.
I'm not sure it's a lack of pressure, because again, when you're establishing yourself at the big league level, there's always that, you know, am I going to be considered a quad A guy? And I think Francis, to be honest, at some point was in that conversation this year. Where you, like when he came back to rotation, I'm going to be honest, I felt like, oh, he's there to soak up innings, because they just don't really have a guy. Like I felt like he was the Ryan Yarbrough of the rotation and he's been so much more than that. Like, you have to tip your hat to him. He's been incredible. There's been tangible differences in what he's doing in terms of, you know, kind of putting that curveball away. That curveball was his best secondary pitch for a long time, the really slow arcing curve. Now he's got a splitter. It works really well off the fastball because it's a very vertically oriented pitch and the pitches tunnel together. The guys at the plate don't know what's coming until it just drops off the table. So he has changed as a guy, but I think that there's an element of patience too. I think of him, another guy I think of is Joey Loperfido.
Sure, yeah.
He performed so poorly when he first came to the Blue Jays. I think he would tell you that too. He was absolutely brutal at the plate. But because the team does not need to win, they can be patient and they can keep rolling him out there. And so he knows if I have a bad day, I'm not going to necessarily ride the pine for 2 weeks.
Right.
I think that's immensely helpful. So Bowden Francis, you know, he hasn't had a bad start to worry about, but if he did, he knows he's going to get that next one. And Loperfido is a good example because over the last couple of weeks, he's been unbelievable.
Well, Bowden Francis is where I wanted to start today, Nick, because 8 hitless innings, gets into the top of the 9th inning at the Rogers Center on Saturday. His stat line, 8 innings pitched, 1 hit, which was the 1 earned run, the home run from Taylor Ward, 3 walks, 12 strikeouts, all these are career highs, and 117 pitches thrown when his previous career high was 95 pitches. I was at the Rogers Center on Saturday watching with Ben and Chris on the radio, and of course you can certainly get the Red Sox series, which starts with game 1 of the doubleheader on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and across the Sportsnet radio network with Ben and Chris. If you're watching on TV, it'll certainly be on television as well across the various Sportsnet channels with Dan Shulman today. But I was at the ballpark on Saturday, and Bowden Francis, I just every time after it got into like the official status, I'm using air quotes here, of becoming a no hitter, because you know it was like carrying a no hitter into like the 5th inning. I'm not sure how much people are really paying attention to it, but you know, he gets into the 7th inning, he gets out of the 7th inning, you think, oh man, it's 6 outs away, like he's only, there's a real chance here. And every one of us was kind of looking down to our left, towards the Blue Jays dugout to see, oh gosh, is John Schneider going to pull him? Like Zach Pop's warming, Yenesis Cabrera's warming, like what are they going to do? And yeah, I mean, Taylor Ward eventually breaks it up, but that has got to be, it's funny because it's got to be the best start of his career, obviously. You know, it's not a hot take to say that, but it's just funny that for 4 straight starts, you have been able to say for Bowden Francis, man, that was the best start of his career. And then the next time out, he goes 6 innings, then 7 innings in that same game. That was the best start of his career. And then the next game, man, that was the best start of his career. And then he turns in an almost no-hitter, which has to be the best start. It's just funny to see him continue this. I think that the through line of this conversation, Nick, has been what Bowden Francis's stature is, much like for Loperfido and a lot of these other guys that we'll talk about, going into 2025. And I'm curious if your decision, because you and I have talked about Bowden Francis a lot this year, if your decision-making on Francis when it comes to is he in the rotation for 2025, if that's changed at all over the last, certainly 4 starts, but maybe even the last 2 starts.
Honestly, it can't not change. And I'm a big believer in large sample sizes and patience and whatnot. But when someone shows you kind of the height of their abilities and that height is well beyond what you thought it was, like you have to pay attention to that.
Right.
You cannot luck yourself into the type of start Bowden Francis just had. And you look at his last 6 outings, it's 5 starts. You know, you're looking at a 1.91 ERA. Oof. You're looking at 36 strikeouts against 5 walks. Like, there's some luck in what's going on. Like, his batting average on balls in play is 141. That normally sits around 300 for most pitchers. So the balls aren't falling in against him. That is a factor in his success. But especially I see the strikeouts and walks. I see the way the splitters come along. In his last 2 games, he has 11 strikeouts on splitters. That is tied with the whole rest of his season combined. So we are seeing the evolution of a guy. And I think he's in the driver's seat for a spot right now. You've got Barrios, Gausman, and Bassett. You can pencil those guys in.
Right.
Yariel Rodriguez, I think there's still a question there. We'll see what he does in the rest of the season. And Francis is right there. And yeah, I think the Blue Jays would probably like to bring someone else into the mix for sure, make it more of a competition. But if I had to guess today, based on what's happening right now, health permitting, is Bowden Francis in the 2025 Blue Jays rotation to start? I would say yes.
Would anything have to happen? Because I've gone back and forth on this myself, I think. But would anything have to happen really negatively for that to for you to change your mind? Like if he gets like completely blown up in the next two starts, would that alter what you've seen? You know what I mean? Like, would that change what you're thinking? Or you think like no matter what, because we've seen, and again, it's not like he has to go against whether it ends up being the Red Sox or the Twins, because you know there's a doubleheader, as a 5-game series. They want to try and get as much rest for these guys as possible. So maybe an extra rest day for some of the starters means that maybe Francis won't pitch the finale of the Fenway series. Maybe he pitches the first game of the Target Field series when the Jays go to Minnesota starting on Friday. And then after that, there are a couple days off next week, right? There's a day off, I think, on Labor Day, and there's a day off on the Thursday as well, because no one wants to compete with the NFL kickoff. So I understand. So because of that, you have two games against the Phillies on, I think it's Tuesday, Wednesday, and then you have a 3-game set in Atlanta, take on the Braves, and then after that you come back home, take on the Mets at the Rogers Center. So there's a real chance he could pitch against any of the Red Sox, Twins, Phillies, Braves, or Mets, essentially. But the truth is, I think for me, I do want to see what he does, but boy, he has got to be in the driver's seat, I think, at this point.
It is relevant what he does for the rest of the year. I don't think you can say he has firmly locked it in, Right. Forget about what he does. I think what you're going to do is you're going to take that chunk of time from when he returned to rotation to the end of the season, and you're going to look at that. Now, this most recent outing, I think, tells you something in a way that some other starts don't necessarily, in terms of what he's capable of.
Right.
So it's a useful data point, probably more useful than some of the other starts he's going to have. But if in the rest of the season he's given up 5 runs every outing, then yeah, that is going to be important. Like Right. Earlier in the year, Yariel Rodriguez, we might have said, okay, that guy seems pretty firmly entrenched in the 2025 rotation based on his contract status and how he's pitching. And he's hit some, you know, he's hit some speed bumps. And I don't think it's as safe to say that anymore. So, you know, we are talking about him at a high point. That is always risky in terms of our takes aging poorly. So we have to keep all of that in mind. And he'll be someone to watch for the rest of the season. Consistency is obviously important, but it's impossible to complain with what he's doing.
Yeah, I've long said to you that, you know, if you're a fifth starter for any team, because I think like most major league teams, their fifth starter situation, like whatever, however you want to describe it, probably has some kind of question mark hovering over it. You know what I mean? Like in some way, shape, or form, even the best teams in baseball have some kind of oddity going on with their fifth starter, because maybe someone's injured, for example. Maybe they need to skip a start. Maybe some guy's performing really poorly. Maybe they only really have 3.5 really reliable major league starters, kind of like the Blue Jays have had.
A lot of teams would love to have 3.5 reliable starters. A lot of teams have, you know, two or one.
Yeah, it's true. So I think that the Blue Jays can, in theory, roll out Gausman, Berríos, Bassett going into 2025, and say what you want about them being a year older and what the results have looked like for them this year. And we're certainly going to talk about Kevin Gausman's start from yesterday, because it was phenomenal. But I think it's important to note that most teams just don't have solid situations 1 through 5. So that the Baden Francis situation could mean that the fifth starter, or maybe even the fourth starter, because you're right, Yariel Rodriguez is not a slam dunk starting rotation guy next season. But that is the situation. I think it's really impressive. But I mean, most teams would take what, like 5 innings, 5 1/3, and 3 earned runs from their fifth starter. Like, if you get that from your, again, using air quotes, like fifth starter, you take that and you run. Like, no matter who that guy is, you take that and run. So if the Blue Jays can get anything close to that from Baden Francis for the rest of the season, and they've gotten way beyond that for most of the last couple of starts, then you're probably pretty happy if you're a Blue Jays fan, if you're a member of the front office, if you're the member of the starting rotation, if you're a member of the bullpen, you're probably pretty happy. Like, I just feel like there's no downside to that, essentially.
Yeah, and in this conversation, we have not even brought up the name Jake Bloss, who's arguably the biggest addition the Blue Jays made at the trade deadline in the Yusei Kikuchi deal. And I think he's someone a lot of people had quasi-penciled into the rotation for 2025 based on where he was ranking on prospect lists and how good he'd been at AAA. And I believe he hasn't given up a run at AAA for the Blue Jays since he's come in sort of small starts, not quite what traditional role.
Like 3-4 innings.
Yeah. So, you know, he hasn't struck out a ton of guys. You could nitpick that. I'm just saying, like, he's someone who is a credible prospect who is nearly, if not MLB ready, who's in this picture as well. And suddenly, you know, the Blue Jays rotation, there's lots of other team building to be done with this team for 2025, but the rotation at the very least in the back end of it has a little bit of potential here.
Yeah, I think for the first time in what feels like ages, there's actually a fair amount of, like, and I use fair again with air quotes, it's a kind of like a relative term. But it feels like there's some depth there in the sense that you can go into, in theory, if you really wanted to, if you really had to, you could go into next year with certainly, you look past Gosman, Berríos, Bassett, you look at the four or five spots. You can go into some into next year with some combination of Jake Blas, Yariel Rodriguez, Bowden Francis, you know, probably two of those three guys for those two spots. And then, you know, at the end of the season, I'm going to be generous and say even with a recovery time of 12 to 14 months with the elbow surgery for Alek Manoah, there is a good chance that Alek Manoah pitches maybe post-trade deadline or maybe for like kind of in the same way that Ryu pitched last year, right? I think Ryu actually came back for the Blue Jays, I think the day of the trade deadline last season. And then he got touched up pretty badly by the Orioles in that first start and then pitched pretty well for the rest of the season, which was a testament to him. And I'm glad he's doing well over in the KBO. But, you know, for Manoah, there is a chance he comes back, and now you have Manoah to contend with, and certainly Ricky Tiedemann, probably not going to be a factor next year because he also got the elbow surgery a little later, so he's probably not going to pitch in 2025. But it just you actually do have a variety of options for the first time in a while. And even, I mean, we did, when Julio's on with me on Jays Talk Plus right after the MLB draft, we did a lot of discussing on Trey Yesevich. And I mean, I don't think he's going to be a rotation member next year, but I think another part of why people were so excited about this guy was also because it's not like you're talking about a high school arm. It was a guy who was a little more closer to being major league ready. And again, pitching prospects are never a sure thing, as we have learned in Toronto these last couple of years. But you actually have some options between now and like the end of 2026 even.
Yeah, that's a very polished prospect you brought. And a guy that fell in the draft to the Blue Jays that people did not expect him to get. Now, on the flip side of that, Bassett is only under contract for one more season, and you're not going to necessarily have that much longer with Gosman either. Berríos has an opt-out. So it's not like you're set sort of deep into the future, but for that short to medium term, the Blue Jays have things cooking to some degree in the rotation. I still think the team would be wise to try and get another guy to compete at the back end of that rotation. It never hurts to have depth there. We know how injuries can hurt a group like that as well. It's easy to lay out a rotation, be like, here's my 1-5. They're fantastic. Right. And then you get out of spring training and two and a half of them are healthy. That's an issue they deal with. But they have fairly durable guys, and that's been a big part of what the Blue Jays have targeted, I think, to their credit. You know, guys like Berríos, notorious for not missing a start. Kevin Gosman has been exceedingly durable. And Chris Bassett had some issues earlier in his career, but before coming to the Blue Jays, he was someone who could really count on for innings. And we saw that, especially in the previous season. Yeah. So because the Blue Jays have really targeted and prioritized durability with these veterans, it does make you believe they might not need, you know, four or five guys behind them, because there's a good chance these guys are going to get through the season. That's what we've seen from them so far, at least.
I think, too, the other aspect of the starting rotation that I've really enjoyed is if Bowden Francis does pan out the way you want him to, if Jake Blas does pan out the way you want him to, and again, you're right, like it's not set in perpetuity, but at least in this short term where the Blue Jays are still saying publicly, hey, we're going to compete in 2025, if you're talking about the laundry list of things that need to be fixed for 2025 to go right and for it to be competitive, I view it in the sense that you can now allocate resources elsewhere. Like, you don't have to allocate millions and millions and millions of dollars to the starting rotation next year, unless like some great deal comes up essentially and you can't pass it up. And in which case I would certainly advocate for that. But I think if you can find, because you don't want them to backfill every position from within the organization, because I think, you know, we talked about the farm system and what it is and what the ceiling for a lot of these guys will be. But if you're talking about resource allocation and what the wisest use of that money will be, because the question is not really will the Blue Jays spend money, it's will they spend money wisely, which I think a lot of people agree they did not necessarily do this past offseason. So they're going to do that this year. I kind of wondered if having the ability to not, or the luxury perhaps of not having to spend tons of cash on the starting rotation, because you have a Blas or a Rodriguez or a Francis, it allows you to allocate more money towards a DH or a third baseman if you really had to, or a left fielder, certainly. I mean, I don't know if it'll be enough money to lure Juan Soto away from the New York Yankees. That'd be kind of fun, but as someone, right? Like someone who can give you some pop and bang some home runs, because that's what the Blue Jays desperately need.
Yeah, when you're building a team, in theory, it's okay to build on top of strengths. You just need to create a certain amount of value, and it doesn't necessarily matter how that value is allocated. But when you have these weaknesses, like say the Blue Jays bullpen, your baseline is so low that it's much easier to create improvements there or in certain positions in the lineup. And so you could spend on top of this rotation, but the Blue Jays rotation baseline is pretty solid. So you're paying for like a relatively small amount of marginal value in theory. Again, if some of these young guys pan out to a certain extent. And so, I think it makes sense to get someone to compete at the back end of the rotation. It's always good to have more depth, but you're probably going to get more bang for your buck trying to improve those areas of the team that look really barren right now. And, you know, the bullpen looks absolutely barren. Like that needs to be completely rebuilt. And the lineup, you know, we're going to learn more about these young guys in the rest of the season. And that's going to be a bit of a mushy situation depending on how they thrive or how they struggle. But with the rotation, it's going to be hard to get improvements that get you the marginal value be worth what they cost in free agency, because free agent starters always cost a decent amount of money if they're reliable.
Yeah, no kidding. It costs you a pretty penny, that's for sure. I think if you're talking about the Corbin Burns of the world, or even like the kind of contracts that get you a Gausman or a Barrios or a Bassett, it's a lot of money for these guys. So I think you're right. If you don't have to be spending top dollar on a lot of the free agent guys, because you're right, I think depth can never hurt. Never ever can that hurt, but the Blue Jays, I'm sure, can spend the money elsewhere. I did want to, before we chat a little bit about Kevin Gausman, wrap up on Baden Francis by getting to some news from Taylor Ward, which was turned some heads. It caused a bit of a stir after the near no-hitter on Saturday. So I'm going to read you his comments and we'll throw it up here on TV. But this is what Taylor Ward said, aggregated, I think, across social media. And Julia Kreutz from MLB.com was the one who gathered these. So thank you, Jules. Taylor Ward, I really don't know, when he was asked about the near no-hitter from Baden Francis, you know, I thought everything was hittable. Maybe to other guys, he made better pitches. A lot of guys were talking about his split and that being on, but personally, I didn't think it was anything special. Now, the way I look at this, Nick, is on one hand, the guy broke up a no-hitter, so he had the literal only hit of the ball game off of a pitcher in the span of 2 hours. So you know what? I think you're probably entitled to say whatever you want, but at the same time, like, why antagonize another team if your team is also pretty terrible? It just seemed unnecessary, and B, it also kind of seemed like almost like you're burying your own team, because it's almost like, yeah, like, why'd you guys suck so much if we all think this guy sucks? I don't know. It's such a bizarre comment to make in the context of, yeah, you almost got no hit, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you say he has the credibility to say it, in a sense, because you're right, he hit the home run. No one else, if anyone else had said it, it would have come off as
that's truly insane. That's what I mean.
But I still think it was bizarre that he did it. You know, for one, you're kind of trying to diminish someone else's accomplishment, which seems, you know, just stupid and senseless. Like, there's no real reason to do that. There's no rivalry between these teams. Like, maybe in some kind of like Red Sox-Yankees scenario, right. You'd get something like this happening, and it's the Blue Jays and the Angels. Nobody cares, like, realistically around the league. Like, there's nothing there. It's classic sort of sore loser type of mentality. The funny thing is, I do think there's a little bit of truth to it. Like, Baden Francis' velocity was a bit down. He did leave some fastballs over the plate. If you look where he threw his fastballs, now he hit the glove side corner really well, especially up in the zone. Like, there were some really nice pitches there. He stole some strikes with the splitter. I do think, you know, his splitter, a lot of why guys are struggling with it is because it's new and they haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Like, that is a part of it. You know, and I think, you know, months from now, weeks from now, there might be a day where people look at his splitter and realize, you know, it's not a Kevin Gausman splitter on sort of pure quality basis. And so maybe they'll have more success with it. And so if you're really drilling down, like, the exact quality of the stuff, how good was it? You can nitpick that a little bit, but it just seems silly to do so. And, you know, clearly, as you said, none of his teammates had any success with him. So yeah, you can say that about a lot of no hitters. Like, to be honest, and this wasn't a full no hitter, but a lot of no hitters, there's a guy who catches a screaming line drive. Sure, there's someone who makes a catch at the wall. There's an amazing double play after someone gets walked. Like, to get a no hitter, to even approach a no hitter, you have generally some element of luck on your side. And so did Baden Francis have some element of luck on his side on that day?
Sure.
Absolutely. But what is the point in pointing that out from Ward's perspective? Especially in a game between two teams out of the playoff race with no rivalry whatsoever. Like, it's normally baseball players do the exact opposite of this. They do whatever they can to avoid creating headlines and making waves. And he's done this for, no reason that I can discern.
I do kind of wonder, like, honestly, I wonder how much of it from Taylor Ward is him still having, and I wouldn't blame him if this was the case, a little bit of sour grapes, because he certainly got hit by Baden Francis in that game. And he's also if you remember from last year, he got absolutely blasted by an Alec Manoah fastball in the face, and he missed like a good chunk of the season after that. So I get maybe he just doesn't have great memories of playing at the Rogers Center. Like, I honestly wonder how much of it is just he has a little bit of a grudge against the Toronto Blue Jays. Like, I almost felt like, at least for me, because, like, with that being in the back of my mind, like, not only getting hit in the game, but having been a pretty, like, serious, awful situation for yourself just a year prior, I do kind of wonder how much of that played into him kind of like letting some of his frustrations slip on a day where your team almost got no hit and then went on to get, like, you got swept by the Jays two consecutive series, essentially both at home and away. So I do wonder if some of it's just like some genuine frustration with the Blue Jays and his general history with them.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like I said, there's no Angels-Blue Jays rivalry. Yeah, yeah. Maybe there is a Blue Jays-Taylor Ward rivalry at this point. I think there certainly is, and, you know, Chris Bassett's mind. We saw him bring out the card to defend Bowden Francis there. And, yeah, I bet you there's frustration because Taylor Ward is one of the few Angels players actually having a decent season, and he has played with a lot of teammates who simply cannot hit in any context, Bowden Francis or no. It's not necessarily fun being Taylor Ward, so I can understand that. But at the end of the day, it's just a silly thing to come out and say.
That is Nick Ashbourn. I'm Sho Ali. You're listening to Jays Talk Plus here on the Sportsnet Radio Network, also on Sportsnet. Nick, let's step aside. And when we come back, I did want to have a conversation with our next guest about playoff odds and certainly chat a little bit about what to expect from this bizarre but kind of fun situation happening with the doubleheader. Danny Jansen going to make some history for both the Blue Jays and Red Sox today. John Becker from FanGraphs is going to join us on the other side. And I see a text here on the text line, 590-590, name and location. You are certainly free to text us if that's your chosen desire. Standard data and messaging rates may apply, as always. But if you want to reach out to us, 590-590, you can do so. But I see a text about playoff odds here, so I want to ask John about that on the other side. So still lots to come here on the program. You're listening to and watching Jays Talk Plus on Sportsnet and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus here on Sportsnet and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sho Ali, Nick Ashbourn here with you. We are filling in for Blake Murphy. Blake is back on Thursday. Hope he's getting some rest or partying. I don't know what he's doing, but I hope
whatever
is best. Yeah, however you recharge, Blake, you do you, pal. I'll see you on Thursday. But joining us right now to chat about all things baseball, chat a little Blue Jays, I'm sure, take a look around Major League Baseball as well, is John Becker, columnist for FanGraphs and contributor to Rotoballer, which I appreciate. John, how are you?
Thank you guys for having me. I'm great. How are you guys doing?
We are great. We appreciate you carving out some time for us. John, look, we're in Toronto, so I feel like we kind of have to start with the Blue Jays, but a fun historical oddity awaits us when game one of this doubleheader not only begins but resumes at Fenway Park. Danny Jansen will catch for the Red Sox, according to Alex Cora. Jansen will become the first player ever to play in the same game for both teams. He was also actually at the plate when this game was suspended. So in theory, he'll catch for the opposing team in the same AB, which is hilarious. This is just one of the many reasons I think we love baseball. No, like having these wacky, silly, strange things happen, I think.
It is awesome. I'm obsessed with it. I'm very excited to turn the game on and probably switch between both teams' broadcasts just to see how they talk about it. It's really cool. It's a little surprising to me that it's never happened before, because I feel like in, you know, 100 some odd years of this game, just about everything has happened. So it's very cool that we ran into something that actually hasn't happened before. And I will definitely be watching. Yeah. So there's Jansen there fouling off someone else's at bat and not Danny Jansen trying to catch the ball. That will then be Danny Jansen. So it's awesome that I can say all that and have it be true somehow.
John, one of the things we appreciate about having you on here is you have such sort of a league-wide focus, whereas we're pretty narrow on Blue Jays a lot of time. I think that's how a lot of baseball fans absorb the league, is like, this is my team, and then I focus on this group, and then maybe I'm occasionally aware when Aaron Judge is approaching some kind of home run record, then I'll pay attention to that. So, you know, Danny Jansen was a trade deadline acquisition, far from the most significant one in baseball. When we look at the competitive landscape right now, which teams do you think are most happy with how their deadline worked in terms of how they're competing today? And which teams do you think have the most regrets?
Yeah, so I think Kansas City comes to mind as one that's crushed it. You know, they were sort of treading water a little bit prior to the deadline. And, you know, I honestly thought that they didn't do quite enough. I thought that, you know, Lucas Ersig being the best reliever they acquired when James MacArthur was struggling so much as their closer was a little bit risky, but Ersig has been absolutely lights out for them and has really transformed the end of games, whereas MacArthur was a little bit shaky. The Astros, you know, weren't super busy, but Yusei Kikuchi has been awesome for them and has really helped to stabilize the rotation, so much so that they've gone to a six man with Verlander back, because just really everyone in that rotation has hit their stride, and the Astros right now look like they're going to run away with yet another AL West title and maybe go to the ALCS for, I think, the eighth straight year it would be.
John, you know, because we're talking about playoff-bound, or we think playoff-bound teams, certainly in the Royals' case, I think there's still some work to be done for them, but we'll see how much of this remains true down the stretch as we enter the last 30, 31 games of the season or so. 31 for the Blue Jays, certainly. You know, I do a lot of the post-game work for the Jays as well on the weekends, and yesterday, after the Jays completed a four-game sweep of the Angels, I think a lot of people want to know about playoff odds for a lot of teams out of the race, certainly here in Toronto, for the Blue Jays. And I'm wondering, I don't want to say it's impossible. Okay, I don't want to be like the Debbie Downer here after they take two series against the Angels.
I'll say it's impossible if you won't. It's pretty damn close.
But here, and this is why, right? Because the way I look at it, John, is I got to think it's not only about what the Royals and the Twins, the teams that are occupying wild card 2 and 3 right now in the AL. It's not only about them. It's about what the Red Sox, the Blue Jays play today for the first of five. But the Red Sox, the Mariners, the Rays, and the Tigers all do, because in theory, in 31 games, if the Blue Jays go like 27-4, which would be absolutely ridiculous, let's say they do that and they get to 90 wins, it does in theory matter what all of the teams, certainly not in the actual wild card positions do, but what the teams in between them do, because if they also in theory keep pace, because the Blue Jays are so far back, it wouldn't really matter. I wonder how you look at playoff odds for teams that are really far out of it, like the Blue Jays, and you know, you can get into the Tigers and Mariners, for example, as well.
Yeah, you know, I don't completely discount anyone until it hits 0% over at Fangraphs. So, you know, White Sox, Rockies, I think the Nationals are just about there at 0%. So do I want to discount the Blue Jays odds completely? No, but you know, when you have 20% of the season left, it's other teams control your destiny just as much as you control your own destiny, because there just simply aren't enough games where you can just close to run the table and make the playoffs. So, yeah, I mean, finishing with 90 wins by going 27-4 probably gets you a playoff spot. But at the same time, you know, you do need those other teams that are in between the Blue Jays and the playoffs to, you know, fall flat on their face to some extent as well. So, you know, for the Blue Jays especially, I look at them as a team where, yeah, it's still theoretically possible, not like, you know, the White Sox going 31-0 or however many games they have left. They're still out of the playoffs, but it would just be too late, I think, even though it is theoretically possible. You know, they're in full-blown evaluation for 2025 mode, as they should be. And that doesn't mean that they're not trying to win every single game that they can, but, you know, very few guys left from those teams with playoff experience.
If you look at the Fangraph playoff odds right now, what you're going to see is, I think it's 11 teams with an 80% or better shot. Like, there's a pretty solidified group of teams that are likely to make the playoffs. If you had to pick a team, and I think, again, we would probably agree with the premise the Blue Jays are not this team. If you had to pick a team that was outside of that group of, you know, nearly surefire playoff teams that you think has a chance to sneak in, who would you say that team might be?
Yeah, it is tough, because for all the talk about parity, and there is a lot of parity in that, we might not have a 100-win team for the first time since 2014, I believe was the last year without. That group is getting pretty solidified. My guess is that it would probably be a National League team. I think things in the AL are more and more solidified every day, especially with the Red Sox fading a little bit. I do think it could be a team like in the NL Central. The Reds, the Cubs are all sort of like hovering around 500. And, you know, when you are at 500-ish at this point in the season, you do have enough time where if you go 20-11, 21-10, whatever it is, you can sneak in. You know, in terms of like remaining schedule, I think that with how a lot of the schedule has become, where everyone plays everyone. Strength of schedule is definitely somewhat less of a factor. Obviously, you know, there's going to be some front-loaded, back-loaded schedules, but I really just look at the quality of the teams themselves, and I could definitely see the Cubs, the Reds, maybe the Giants. You know, the Mets are outside of a playoff spot, but not very far behind. You know, really just ripping off a whole bunch of wins and sneaking their way into the playoffs. I think it's a lot tougher for an AL team to do that. The Mariners, for example, I think their only realistic path would be winning the AL West, and that looks tougher and tougher every day.
We're chatting with John Becker, columnist for Fangraphs, here on Jays Talk Plus. Show and Nick with you until the top of the next hour, after which point we'll make way for Roger Lajoie. I did want to ask you, kind of along the same lines, John, as Nick's question about like teams that could still make it or teams that have deceptive records, for example. Well, when you look at actual World Series threats across the realm of baseball, and you mentioned the idea of parity, I think parity has somewhat made that question harder to answer, if that makes sense, just because, like, yeah, I mean, like, yeah, the Yankees, the Orioles here in Toronto, we talk about those two teams a lot because the Blue Jays play them a lot. But I mean, outside of those two teams, are there a lot of really credible World Series threats? Like, I think you can say the Dodgers, certainly. You can say the Phillies, probably. But I mean, I feel like I can almost count on maybe one hand that the amount of teams I would not be surprised if they won the World Series, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, I think like we saw last year, it really can just be timing of getting hot, sure, at the right time, having some clutch hits. You know, I think a team like the Guardians definitely comes to mind. You know, they've had a really good bullpen all year. And yeah, it is a lot of younger guys who I could totally see wearing down by the time the playoffs come around. But I mean, we've also seen that their offense started out really good. It went to being really bad for, I think, almost 2 months. And then they broke out for 11 or 12 runs yesterday. So we'll have to see if that continues. But I mean, they're a team that if the bats are clicking, you know, they have enough bullpen, which really, just going back to those Royals teams, 2014-15, has sort of become the way to really win in the playoffs, is how many good relievers do you have? How many starters do you have who can go down to the bullpen and succeed? Definitely makes the Guardians something of a World Series threat. But you know, once you make it in, there's no team that I would want to discount whatsoever, because Diamondbacks Rangers was probably the single least likely World Series matchup of last year, and yet it happened. So I think that's why, you know, going back to the trade deadline, we saw a lot of teams going for it, and we'll continue to see a lot of teams go for it as long as there's expanded playoffs, because really all you have to do is get in, and then it's anyone's game.
Let's get a fourth wild card in there. What do you think, Nick?
Oh, yeah, that's what we need in baseball. Just more teams shooting for 500. Absolutely. John, we've been talking a lot about the playoff odds, and that's how sometimes we would absorb it. But I don't know if that's what every fan is going to Fangraphs and, you know, looking at those numbers. I think what a lot of fans would do, especially fans of one team, say the Blue Jays or any other team, will go and just kind of look at the standings. And maybe if they're feeling spicy, a little bit of run differential. But like just that, you know, the MLB standings page, take a look at like, oh, how's the race developing? When you look at the standings, you kind of alluded to this with the Guardians in terms of maybe they're more of a threat than they look like because of how the team is structured. But which teams you look at and say, oh, that team is probably better than their record, whether it's based on injuries or, you know, players they got at the deadline, or maybe this team has a good record, but I have less faith in them because of factors of how they're playing right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think like you look at teams like the Astros and Twins who have ended up being really good, but they both got off to tough starts. The Twins were 7-13. The Astros were 12-24. And you know, I'm not a big fan of the stats where it's like, oh, if you just take out these games, then they're elite. But it's a lot easier to do that when those games are at the very beginning of the season. So I think those two teams might be even better than people give them credit for. The Twins being, I believe, even in third place. I think the Royals are ahead of them now. And the Astros, you know, being in first place, but maybe not by as much as they could be. Those teams are legitimate threats because they've been two of the best teams in baseball since their poor starts. And, you know, the Twins doing it largely without Carlos Correa, with his plantar fasciitis, Royce Lewis having missed a lot of games, Byron Buxton hurt right now, and the Astros doing it without Kyle Tucker and without a lot of their pitching that won't be back at any point this year. Christian Javier, Luis Garcia are done for the year. you know, that's incredibly impressive. And if they get even some semblance of health back for the playoffs, assuming they both make it, then those are some extremely dangerous teams who, you know, whose early season struggles sort of watered down just how good they are. And I think they're a lot closer to, you know, the teams that they've looked like since those last 20 to 36 games of the season versus, you know, their holistic record right now.
You know, John, I did want to dive into the MVP races with you as we approach the last, like 30, 31 games of the MLB calendar here. And we saw Vladimir Guerrero Jr., it's funny, get intentionally walked yesterday twice. And I wonder, I mean, Aaron Judge, the man hit his 51st home run of the season last night. He had two home runs yesterday to get to the 50 and then 51 mark plateau. I wonder why aren't people intentionally walking Judge more? Like, I mean, this guy is the runaway favorite for AL MVP. And I understand, like, in a theoretical sense, you know, baseball is a game of failure. If you hit at a 30% clip, you're one of the better hitters in baseball. But I do wonder, I mean, with Aaron Judge at this rate, even with Soto in front and Stanton behind him, I do kind of wonder sometimes what the impetus would be for not throwing up four fingers every time he walks up to the batter's box.
Yeah, you know, I don't understand it either. I get it in that, you know, a guaranteed base runner is worse than, you know, the expected number of bases that even the best hitters like Aaron Judge will give you. But also, if there's, you know, two outs and it's Stanton or Wells, I would rather have that, no offense to those two guys, than face Aaron Judge. So, you know, do I think he needs the Barry Bonds treatment? Not quite, but I think that it is interesting to me how many pitchers are not just not walking him, but pitching to him and throwing him strikes is very interesting because, you know, he won't get himself out much, but I think doing the unintentional intentional walk, even if he hits a single or, you know, he hit a home run on a 3-0 pitch that was probably two baseballs inside last week. So even that has risks, but I understand that a lot more than throwing him actual strikes to hit. So I've never quite wrapped my head around it, especially with, you know, Wells and Stan behind him instead of Soto. It is bizarre to me. I would definitely do it more if I was a manager, but I understand why, you know, it's gotten out of vogue in the game the last 5 years or so as well.
It's interesting you referenced Barry Bonds there because I did want to ask how close we're getting to Barry Bonds territory. Because if you look at, you know, WRC plus, which is a good sort of individual catch-all stat for all offense, you know, not perfect because no metric is, but Judge is at 226 this year. You look at Bonds in those crazy seasons, you know, the early 2000 seasons, you're looking at 235, 244, 212, 233. So it's not as good as Bonds, but we're sniffing the same neighborhood. And I almost feel like Judge might not be getting enough credit because offense has been down around the league and just and he's been better. So that gap is even bigger. That's why you get a number as big as 226. I'm wondering what, like, how close are we to that point where people might get, you know, the Bonds tipping point, for lack of a better term, with him and just come to the conclusion that it's just not worth it?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's the best hitter since Bonds. I think he's the best right-handed hitter since, like, I don't even know how far back we have to go. Maybe Henry Aaron, maybe Willie Mays, in terms of pure offensive production. And, yeah, I maybe he's not quite getting enough credit. I mean, he had 300 home runs faster than anybody, almost a full season's worth of games faster than anybody. I mean, the things he is doing at the plate is just incredible. It's not just home run hitting. It's striking out less than he ever has. It's hitting over 330. It's hitting the ball the other way. It's, you know, taking what he's given when he is getting successfully pitched around. I mean, I don't want to say that we're numb to it or not giving him enough credit because, you know, he plays in the biggest media market in the country and gets plenty of credit. But, I mean, this is unprecedented just how good he is. And I get that, you know, some holistic stats like wins above replacement are not going to view him as, you know, heads and shoulders above the rest because he plays an okay center field. And I totally understand why WAR wouldn't give him a ton of credit for that versus Bobby Witt Jr., who plays an excellent shortstop and is hitting 345. But you know, this is the best hitter that any of us will see in our lifetimes, I think. So, you know, just savor that. And he's just amazing to watch. And, you know, let's not lose sight of how incredible he's been since he came up, despite being something of a late bloomer.
Yeah, Aaron Judge, the runaway favorite, I would think. If he could stop playing today, probably, and still win the AL MVP the way he has been playing. John, look, we appreciate you doing this for us, man. Thank you so much. It's great to chat with you, and hopefully towards the end of the season we can do it again.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
There he goes. That's John Becker, columnist for Fangraphs and contributor at Rotoballer as well. Yeah, I mean, 51 home runs for Aaron Judge, Nick. It's just ridiculous. One of the two home runs, actually, I don't know if you saw it, but he kind of just sticks his bat out and just slaps that thing. Like, just he's so strong, he just slaps it into the bullpen out there in left field. He just is incredibly impressive. It is funny, though. I genuinely think, like, if you're doing the MVP ladder of the AL right now, I think John just mentioned Bobby Witt Jr. at the end there. I would say Bobby Witt Jr. is number two. But, you know, earlier in the season, like if we were talking, doing this exercise in May, let's say, well before the All-Star break, it was probably like Judge, Soto, certainly Bobby Witt Jr., Gunnar Henderson, Kyle Tucker, Jose Ramirez. Those are probably like the likeliest candidates. Jose Ramirez, I still think, is one of the most under-discussed, like, superstars, to use a better, lack of a better term, but one of the most underappreciated stars maybe in all of baseball. But honestly, I think if you were to make a list of MVP candidates in the AL right now, you tell me if I'm being a massive homer by saying this, but after Judge and Bobby Witt Jr., I think I feel comfortable putting Vladdy above, I mean, Kyle Tucker, I think his, unfortunately, because of the injury, is no longer in the conversation, but above Gunnar Henderson, above Jose Ramirez, I think I'd probably put Vladdy up there.
I have a hard time with that. I mean, Soto's got to go in above Vladdy
Soto
as well.
Soto, I forgot about Soto.
You know, Henderson, I think, you know, you're looking at slightly better offensive numbers for Vladdy, but there's just a huge gap in what those two players offer from a defensive standpoint.
Sure, yeah.
And so, I think with Vladdy, if you're talking Vladdy, MVP Vladdy, in terms of him being, you know, one of the best players in the league, I think what you're really talking about is sort of since the start of June, right? Like it's since he began this run that he's currently on, because he has those first 2 months of the season where he hit for almost no power and he's kind of slapping singles around and taking his walks, still broadly effective, but like not a superstar by any stretch of the imagination. But since then, when you're talking about, since the beginning of June, he's fourth in home runs in all of baseball, third in WRC plus. In the second half, he's fifth in home runs, but he's second WRC plus to Aaron Judge. Mm. That's when you're talking about, okay, Vladdy is truly at that superstar, one of the very best players in the league. It's just, you know, a third of his season went down this hole of being solid, but not unbelievable.
All right. You know what? I did admittedly, when I was making that list up in my head, forget about Juan Soto, but I think I would still, I'm not saying I would take Vladdy necessarily over Gunnar Henderson in a vacuum, because I think a lot of people, you bring up the fact that they play different positions. I mean, Vladdy plays largely first base. Maybe he plays at third going forward, but even if that's the case, Gunnar Henderson plays shortstop, so it's probably the most valuable position on the diamond. So if that's the case, then yeah, I think it's like a comparable, at least. Gunnar Henderson, also as young as Vladdy is, even younger. So there's a little bit of differential there. But I mean, gosh, I mean, if Vladdy is what at worst, like the fifth best player in the AL on the whole of the season, like when you include the first third of the season, that's still, I think that does speak to how well he's played in the stretch you just outlined.
Yeah, I mean, we've had so many discussions, you and I and anyone who's been a part of Blue Jays talk or radio or podcast writing, however you want to put it, about Vladdy and building around him and signing a potential extension with him. And to sign the extension that he's going to want, you have to believe that this is a foundational player that you can build an entire, you know, playoff caliber lineup around. And he is showing that right now. And he's showing that, again, even if you kind of loop in the beginning of the season where he was not particularly spectacular, his pure offensive numbers are not far from where he was in 2021 in terms of compared to league average, because 2021 was a better offensive environment that plays in. But if you just talk about compared to league average, he has been truly elite, truly one of the best, kind of 10 hitters in all of baseball. And when you have a guy who's that good and that young, you generally want to sign them to extension.
You do. I think we are all awaiting that the pass and tweet to drop when we see what Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is going to get from the Toronto Blue Jays. I do want to actually continue talking about Vladdy on the other side. Bob Nightingale from USA Today had a report about the possibility of Vladdy playing third base more frequently, certainly this season, but in the future as well. So we'll chat about Vladimir Guerrero Jr. on the other side, chat a little bit about Alejandro Kirk, Barger, Loperfido, a lot of guys having good days against the Angels, certainly yesterday, but a lot of guys' numbers starting to creep up as well. Chat a lot more about the Red Sox as well. Alex Speer going to join us at the bottom of the hour. Still lots to come here on Jays Talk Plus. I'm Sho, that's Nick. You're listening to it on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, the Sportsnet Radio Network, and you're watching on Sportsnet.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus, Hour 2 here on the program. Sho Ali and Nick Ashbourne here with you until the top of the next hour. Roger Lajoie will follow us. Hope you're having a great day. Hope Blake's having a great day. Blake's back on Thursday. Hope you're all doing well. I wanted to chat a little bit with you, Nick, about something we left off at the bottom of the previous hour, or I guess bottom of the previous hour, chatting about the report from Bob Nightingale and from USA Today. He has the column that goes up every Sunday morning, and you know he kind of has like a larger story, and then he has a bunch of little like around the base paths, little snippets from different teams. And you know, when we were at the trade deadline, a lot of it was trade deadline focused, as it usually is for most publications. But the reason I'm bringing it up is because I'm always on the look. I kind of go and control F and type in the Jays and see what comes up, and I do read the whole thing, but I do often get very tantalized by whatever Bob has to say about the Blue Jays, mainly because there is a lot of different things he says, whether it was the deadline or the nuggets about Bo Bichette from last week potentially being traded in the offseason. And yesterday, I'm going to read you verbatim what he said, okay? This is from his column from published yesterday morning. The Blue Jays are exploring the possibility of having Vladimir Guerrero Jr. play third base next season and plan to use him there more frequently in September. Guerrero has not been an everyday third baseman in 4 years, but considering there is a deep crop of free agent first basemen this winter, led by Pete Alonso and Christian Walker, it will be much easier to fill a hole at first base than at third base. That's the quote from Bob Nightingale. I find it really interesting because, first of all, I agree with his premise, the second part of that, which is that it's easier to find first baseman than it is to find third baseman, as we know. And it's interesting because we kind of left off talking about whatever contract Vladdy might get. Yeah, it's going to be for a lot of money, as we know. But, I mean, if they're going to make him play third base, I mean, sure, you can give a lot of money to Pete Alonso. You'll probably give a little bit less money to Christian Walker because he's a little older. He's going to be 34 by the beginning of next season. Pete Alonso is going to be 30 by the beginning of next season. So, a decent gap there. Pete Alonso, one of the better power hitters probably in all of baseball. But, I wonder how that plays out. And when you hear that quote, I wonder what you feel, because when I read it, I thought to myself, boy, like, I guess you can get by with Vladdy at third base. I don't know if I like prefer him playing at third base, but I mean, if that's the way the Blue Jays go, if you can get even passable production out of him at third, then maybe that is the route to go if you can more easily replace a lot of home runs and a lot of production at first, for example.
Yeah, I remain a little bit skeptical about it, to be honest. You know, we've seen that Vladdy grades out as, you know, in some cases a below average defender at first. You can choose to trust the metrics as much as you want. It's a bit of a complicated situation, but no one is saying, oh, this guy is absolutely electric at first. I know he makes the occasional individual stretching play that is really fun to watch, but people don't think of him as that unbelievable defender at first. So then you're going to move him to a significantly harder position. And the way that he sometimes struggles to move laterally and prevent balls from leaving the infield, that would be worse at third base. He'd have to come in on a lot of choppers and bunts. And the reality is he's a big, big man. He does not move that well. Now, he throws the ball really well. So that is an asset that would be more useful at third than first base.
Sure.
But if they were to do this, and again, I think actions will speak louder than words on how much he plays for the rest of the season and what they do in spring training. But if he does this, I think what you're looking at and yeah, this is a comparison I've made before, but I think it's apt, is you're looking at that Detroit Tigers model where they had Miguel Cabrera, who's at first base, but then they had the opportunity to bring in Prince Fielder, and then they moved Cabrera to third base, and they kind of knew and acknowledged, we're not going to get a great defensive third base here. But the value of having Cabrera and having Prince Fielder and Victor Martinez to, to a lesser extent in that DH spot, that value offensively is so high that we're willing to make that sacrifice. And if that's what the Blue Jays do, I can understand the logic behind it. But you really have to nail the first base when you're bringing it. Like, that has to be a really good player to justify that move in my book. Like, the guys you're talking about, like, yeah, Pete Alonso, like a real impact bat to make the sacrifice at third base. Like, Blue Jays fans have watched a lot of good third base recently. Like, I've watched Matt Chapman and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa when he was here. You know, Ernie Clement plays a good third base.
Even Espinal wasn't a bad third baseman.
Espinal was a good third baseman as well. Josh Donaldson when he was in town. Like, if you have Vladimir Guerrero Jr. playing a full season at third base, like, this is going to be a shock to the system potentially. And I'm not saying he'd be a disaster, but it is fair to project him to be below average at that spot. So you have to make sure, if I am losing value, am I gaining requisite value elsewhere? And that would depend on what other transactions they're able to make. And we referred to his contract situation and the potential for extension. If he and his agents can argue, I am a third baseman, that makes a big difference in how much money he can command. And so you don't necessarily want to kind of like manipulate your player's playing time based on trying to negotiate the contract, but that is a factor they're going to think about. Like, that you have to be kind of ruthless with these things. So it's interesting, you know, and you know, the last, since the end of 2019, he's played 10 games at third base. Five of them have come since July 27th this year. So like in the last month, essentially, and he's played consecutive games for the first time. There is some movement here. I just don't know if it's as much movement as that quotation implies.
I do wonder about it because, I mean, we can make the comparison to someone we've often talked about recently, which Blue Jays fans are going to see later today in Rafael Devers, who again is a third baseman who signed his 10-year, $313.5 million deal in January of 2023. So we're just a little over a year and a half, I guess, of Rafael Devers going into his new contract. And I only bring up Devers. I bring up Devers because of the money, certainly, because I think a lot of people, if you're prior to this year, if you were making the comparison between Vladdy and Devers, you probably would have said Devers had been the more consistent offensive talent. You know, I know Vladdy obviously had the 2021 season, but since 2021, Devers has been phenomenal, right? He's been one of the best players in baseball, period. And but I also think it's similarly, Devers, I believe, is 27. He's going to be 28 in a month or so. So by the beginning of next season, like, the next season is his full 28-year-old season. And, you know, he signed that deal for 10 years, so 9 more years after this season for the Red Sox and Devers, which is, it's just great. You feel pretty good about locking up one of your franchise cornerstones if you're the Boston Red Sox. I only bring it up because I also think, like, probably halfway through that deal, there will be a conversation about moving Devers to first base or moving him out of the third base spot, because similar to the conversation about Vladdy, Devers is like a, he's like an okay defensive third baseman. Like,
you might be generous.
Yeah. Like, you're, the value you're getting from Devers is not from his play at third base on the diamond. It's from the bat, because his bat is insanely good. And that's why they gave him all the money they did. It's a very similar conversation to Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And I do wonder, let's just say, for the sake of this conversation, he is going to play 80 games at third base in 2025. If that is the case, and then like the other 80, 81 games, 82 games are played by Ernie Clement at third base, and that's your third base situation for next year. I agree with you. Like, it really, you can't have Spencer Horwitz at first base next year then. Spencer Horwitz, I'd be perfectly happy with him being your everyday second baseman, but you then essentially guarantee yourself needing like a Christian Walker, a Pete Alonso, a Rhys Hoskins if he doesn't end up opting back in with the Brewers. I don't know if Josh Bell or Paul Goldschmidt, for example, at this stage of their careers would be worth, like, to your point about the value lost and gained between first and third. I don't know if it'd be worth it for those guys, but I just, it's an interesting balancing act, certainly, because I also wonder if you're going to give Vladdy a 12-year deal, let's say, for like $360-something million, let's just say, then the other part of that conversation has to be, well, you're probably not signing any replacement first baseman all that long term. You know what I mean? Like, if it's Christian Walker, then the point is moot, right? Because he's 34 years old at the beginning of the next season. So, well, you sign Christian Walker to like a 2-year deal, a 3-year deal with an option in that third year, maybe. And then Vladdy after that goes back to first base, maybe, right? I think your Cabrera, Fielder Martinez comparison with the Tigers is an apt one, because I can't help but think you're going to see, even if Vladdy, even if he starts the year as like your opening day third baseman, I mean, generally speaking, he's still going to see a ton of time at first anyways.
Yeah, I think what the Blue Jays are potentially doing, and to be fair, this is a report. This is not what we have seen yet, although he's played a little bit more third base. Well, again, this will be something to watch for sure in the weeks to come. I think what they're doing is trying to determine the feasibility of that avenue. Like, it's not necessarily that they are planning, oh, our plan is we're going to put him at third and we're going to bring in a first baseman. Because they can't know right now who that first baseman might be. They just know that it's a more robust market out there for quality bats at first base. So I think what they want to determine is Vladdy good enough that we can survive with him out there and really attack the top of the market there and try and reform an offense that has been disappointing for two consecutive seasons. And that's, you know, that's one way to do it, to maximize offense, is absolutely to get a bat first player and Vladdy at third base and then bring in, you know, another bat first player at first, which, you know, that's basically every first baseman, to be honest.
Yeah.
And so that is what I think we're seeing here. I think we're seeing them testing the waters. Is that a plan we can put into action? Because right now, I don't think they have enough information to say this is the plan. They don't know which first baseman might be interested in coming, at what price, is it something they can live with? And I also don't think they know enough about Vladdy at third base either. Like, he's only played a handful of games a season. So you're going to get more information about both of those things and then see if in the offseason, is this a plan that we can put together?
I do wonder about, and again, for the sake of this conversation, if he does see any time at third base going forward, and you're right, like for the rest of this season, if you're talking about auditions, that's certainly, Vlad is going to be on the team next year, but it's an audition in terms of how you're going to focus different efforts in the offseason when it comes to resource allocation, as we discussed with Bowden Francis, for example. But, I mean, it does, I think, factor in the play, or has to factor in the play of a lot of the young guys as well. And we talk about auditions for 2025. It's going to factor in the play of Addison Barger. It's going to factor in the play of Joey Loperfido. It's going to factor in the play of Spencer Horwitz and Ernie Clement and Davis Schneider. And all of these guys have had very different seasons, obviously. But, I mean, on Barger and Loperfido, these two guys on Friday night played the heroes in the ninth inning, home runs, a game-tying home run from Joey Loperfido, and then a game-winning home run from Addison Barger. And, you know, you look at those two guys in particular, and I mean, Addison Barger could be, in theory, part of the solution at third base or in right field, for example, if you don't want to play Springer as much. I'm not as convinced as to his role on the 2025 Blue Jays, if only because it now seems like there's a massive logjam in the infield when you include Will Wagner, for example, as well. But Joey Loperfido, I find really interesting because you brought this up off the very top of the show, Nick, that Loperfido is someone who had a miserable start to the year, like with the Blue Jays, I should say. He comes over from the Sugarland Space Cowboys, which is one of my favorite minor league team names, but he goes to the Bisons, or he goes to the major league team right away instead of going to the Bisons, and then he has a pretty poor start with the Blue Jays. And since, like, I think it was like 4-for-36, I think he had a stretch there at one point, snapping an 0-for-24 stretch as well early on in his relatively young Blue Jays career, he's had a pretty great recent stretch here, to the point where I wonder about his role as, let's say, the fourth outfielder next year over that of Davis Schneider, who really has, I don't want to say has been terrible, but he has really taken a nosedive in production. I do think he can turn it around, but it just, a lot of these situations seem very fluid. And I mean, if you're talking about trends, Loperfido is trending upward while Schneider is trending a little bit downwards.
Yeah, I mean, Loperfido in his last 10 games, he's slugging .806 with 7 extra base hits. And this is what people said about him coming in. They said, listen, this is a guy who is fast and athletic. He can play all around the outfield. He can even play a little infield for you as well. He's a left-handed, but like, there are so many positive things to say about him as a prospect. That's why he was very well regarded in Houston's system. But what everyone also said was that this guy strikes out a ton. He struggles to make contact with the baseball. And so until he can refine that, it's going to be hard for him to be a quality MLB player. And when he first came over, everyone had that kind of confirmation bias kick in because he struck out all the time. He was swinging at high pitches a lot, like struggling to hold up on things outside the zone. In the last few weeks here, you know, he's been more controlled. Like, the strikeouts aren't totally gone, and I don't think they ever will be totally gone. But he's been much more controlled in his approach, and that's letting his natural power sing. And I don't know what his ultimate ceiling is there, but he's a guy who can really drive the ball, which is something the Blue Jays have lacked. And so his ceiling as a player, like, if you combine his speed and his raw power, and if he can get that approach a little bit tighter, like, unlike some of the other guys, I think, like, some of the other guys have a tougher road to being an everyday player. Like, you could picture Joey Loperfido everyday player. Now, I don't think he can do enough in the rest of this season to prove it. I don't think, even right. if he was really hot to end this year, I think he would still be, like you say, you know, fourth outfielder competing for a spot, maybe a platoon bat, something like that. Like, there's just not enough runway for him to prove himself, I don't think. But what they've seen from him lately has been just a lot more life in the bat. And if the bat is going to play, the rest will play, because the guy can run around the outfield and he can make some pretty impressive catches out there.
I try and be careful with these kinds of things, because, and again, I'm not trying to say David Schneider should be a cautionary tale by any means, because I really do truly believe that there is a path back for him. It's just, he really is in the weeds right now. He's really struggling. But I think you look at David Schneider. I mean, we talked about the impressive debut Will Wagner had when he first started his career. I mean, David Schneider had an even more impressive debut at Fenway Park. Like, over the course of 3 weeks, all David Schneider did was rake, essentially. And as with most things, baseball is a game of adjustments. Pitchers did adjust to David Schneider. And then I think there was a period of time this year, especially when George Springer was really struggling, then he was sick for a little while. David Schneider was batting leadoff atop the lineup. And I think it's essentially since June that he's had an OPS hovering around like the 500s. And again, pitchers have now once more adjusted to David Schneider. And I only bring that up because, again, I don't want to pick on the guy, but I think it is a reminder that for Joey Loperfido, for Addison Barger, who's socked another home run yesterday as well, for Will Wagner, for any of these young guys, even for Ernie Clement and Spencer Horwitz, I think to a lesser degree with them because we've seen more of them, but for a lot of them, even as we discuss 2025, it's about finding out, getting as much data as you humanly possibly can, because what's the number we usually settle on when it comes to, like, oh, this is enough plate appearances, this is enough ABs. What's that number, like 400, 500?
Oh, I mean, it can be way more potentially, you know? Like, it could be 1500, sure, sometimes, like, yeah, a couple of seasons before you feel comfortable. Like,
that's what I mean.
Think of the roller coaster we had with Vladdy. Like, he's been a totally different caliber of hitter season to season a lot of the times, and it took this year for him coming back around close to that MVP type of bat for people to kind of lock in and think, okay, we're comfortable saying he's an elite bat. Like, it can take, especially the younger guys, like, it can take a really long time. What's interesting about Loperfido, I think, in particular, is that he is a very volatile prospect. He is someone who could be unplayable at the big league level. Like, truly, he could be someone who's just, he can't make enough contact, and therefore it doesn't make sense to have him on a major league roster, right, or he could be an everyday player. And so that's one of the things that makes him compelling compared to some of the other ones. Like, I take a Will Wagner, extremely polished at the plate, like, excellent approach in Buffalo, but from a raw power standpoint, like, he's probably not going to hit enough to ever be a star level hitter, and he doesn't play a premium defensive position. So as a result, like, a guy who hits like him, if you are a great defensive shortstop, maybe be like, okay, this is kind of a star level hitter. But because he's not that, he's sort of a first baseman, second baseman, he's someone who you might say have a higher floor, pretty likely to play a big league role of some kind, but a lower ceiling. Like, is he ever going to be a star? Is he ever going to be even someone you pencil in every single day? It's a little bit difficult to imagine that happening. And so they have this kind of hodgepodge. Like, no one they have right now is someone that's like, this is a surefire everyday starter for the Blue Jays going forward. Instead, they've got these bundle of guys, and some of them, again, are more volatile. Some of them have a tighter range of outcomes, and you're sort of hoping that one or two of them pop, and that's really what it's about. Like, not all the, like, Addison Barger might be someone we don't even remember 3 years from now, or he might be their everyday third baseman. Like, all these things are in play, but I think when you think of the Blue Jays prospects at this moment, there's so much uncertainty because they do not have the Vladdy equivalent, the Bo equivalent, even to an extent like an Alejandro Kirk equivalent, how well he hit in the minor leagues, and we knew he was a catcher, and so it felt comfortable that he was going to be a big league player. Instead, they've got this bundle of high variance lottery ticket type of guys, and the hope is that one or two of them are going to pop. And like you mentioned, the logjam, I tend to believe that logjam will sort itself out because there's going to be attrition here. Some of these guys are going to get hurt and maybe never be the same. Like, again, I don't want to be super grim and pessimistic about it, but that's the reality. Some of them will get hurt, maybe won't be the same. Some of them will get figured out. Some of them just won't make the adjustments necessary. But because the guys they're trading, like you say, Kikuchi was the closest to a big trade chip they had.
Yeah.
You're just not getting the prospects back who are like the blue chip guys who are at the top of those lists, who everyone's like, okay, set and forget it. That's your second baseman for life. Like, they just don't have those guys. Aurelvis Martinez was probably the closest thing, and he was the one who got suspended.
Yeah, it's tough. It is tough. But I think, I mean, to your point about the Kikuchi trade, I think that they did get prospects on the level of Bloss and Loperfido and Wagner Anyways, I actually thought it
was a good outcome business, for them, right? For sure.
Yeah. I wanted to read a couple of texts here. 590, 590, name and location. At the bottom of the hour, we are going to chat with Alex Speer from the Boston Globe. Get the Boston Red Sox looking ahead of game one of two today, although there is rain in the forecast for Fenway Park. Thanks a lot, Fenway. Thanks a lot, Boston. But anyways, we'll see if we actually get both of these games in today. The first of five games because of the doubleheader against the Red Sox at Fenway Park in Boston. But 590, 590, name and location. That's the people's text line. It is always open, as I like to say. Standard data and messaging rates may apply. We'll start with Ian in Brampton. Ian said the best part, he was talking about the Francis start. The best part about the Francis start is the khakis couldn't pull him and Schneider let him go out and throw 115 plus pitches. Beautiful to see. It's true. I will say that in the moment, every time, especially when he blew past his previous career high, which was 95 pitches prior to Saturday, I thought to myself, man, if they take him out of this game before he gives up a hit because of pitch count, people are going to lose their minds. And even I, like, who I think I've defended it at times, even I think I would have to have been, yeah, like, you can't have this. Like, let the guy go. Even, like, the game doesn't actually mean anything beyond what it means to Bowden Francis specifically. So I am glad that did not become a talking point on Saturday.
If you had some truth serum, though, I think, I don't know for sure, but I think that there'd be a part of John Schneider who was a little bit happy that that got broken up. Because if that had gotten to 135 pitches, you know, like 138 pitches, like it would have gotten to a point where, and again, like you really want to see Francis do this, especially a guy who's taking kind of longer to establish himself in his career. You never know. Like this might be his moment. And, you know, chances are that's as close as he's ever going to come to this accomplishment. So I'm with you. I would have liked to see that. Another thing that's funny about that text is that in this city, and again, I mean, you guys are seeing me on TV now. Like I'm not someone you should go to for sartorial advice by any stretch of the imagination, but the item of clothing of khakis has just been so thoroughly tainted. And I think that's kind of unfair. I feel like khakis are taking a stray here,
yeah,
but just as a result of a disappointing front office performance. And it's not totally fair. And again, I'm not going to be the person with the credibility to bring them, you know, the defense that potentially they need. But it is interesting to me that that one piece of clothing is just absolutely dead in Toronto.
I am a jeans guy more than khakis, I will say. I don't think I own a pair of khakis, actually, now that I think about it, which is probably for the best.
I don't even know if there's a firm way to define it enough for me to be sure whether I own khakis or not. I will say they've taken on a pretty negative connotation in a variety of contexts in recent years, so I don't think it's something you want to proudly say that you're like, I'm a big khakis guy.
Probably not. Yeah, probably not, especially around here. Don in St. Catharines says, what if the Jays, we're talking about the third base, aspect of Vladdy's future. Don in St. Catharines says, what if the Jays want to move Vladdy to third to make room for Horwitz and Wagner at first and second? It's not ideal, but I feel that's more realistic based on what this front office has done in the past. I think, you know, I said this to you when we were discussing it. I'm not sure I would want Horwitz as your everyday first baseman, if only because I think it's easier to find a power hitter in free agency to be your first baseman, especially like I really like the idea of, because I think Pete Alonso is going to cost a lot of money. So if you can't get Pete Alonso, I would be perfectly happy with a Rhys Hoskins or a Christian Walker. I don't know how realistic either of those two options are, but I would take either of those two over either Horwitz or Wagner. But I also, with Don's mention of those two, I kind of wonder, like, if you went into next year, and I know people hate the idea of platooning multiple positions, much less one, because we've seen a lot of that this year, but if you go into next season as Horwitz has like the strong side of a second base platoon, he's getting like 75% of the starts at second base for the most part next season, and the other starts are going to Will Wagner. I think there's so much to be discussed about Will Wagner because he hasn't played a lot, but I do think I'd be at least okay with the Horwitz half of it. And even if it was a mix for the other 25% of Wagner and Clement and Jimenez and other guys, I think that I'd find that acceptable if Horwitz was getting the vast majority of starts.
If the Blue Jays go into next season with that alignment, I think it's worth being pretty disappointed in it, because you have to have a lot of faith that both Horwitz and Wagner are, you know, credible everyday starters. You mentioned a platoon with Horwitz, like he really has not hit left-handed pitching yet at the big league level. So that is something I think they'll consider to a certain extent, is playing matchups with him. Wagner also a lefty, so then that gets a bit awkward. You know, Spencer Horwitz's bat, I love it at second base, because I think he projects a sort of a slightly above average hitter. And if you have that at second base, you've got a good starter. And if you have that at first base, you've got kind of an adequate player. And Wagner, I just don't think we know enough about him yet to pencil him in. Like, he's a guy who, at 26 made his MLB debut, and a lot of his success at AAA was based on plate discipline. It's hard to know how that's going to carry over to the big leagues. We've seen a lot of players who have great kind of walk to strikeout numbers at AAA, and then they come to the big leagues and they can't find that same success. So that's an outcome that is technically possible based on the guys they have on the roster. But what I was talking about before was, if you put Vladdy at third, you are sacrificing value at the defensive side at a relatively important position. You got to get that value back. Yeah. And I don't think you're getting that value back with guys like Horwitz and Wagner.
Speaking of which, I wanted to wrap up on this text before we chat to Alex Speer on the other side from the Boston Globe. Ruben in Alberta says, so if Vladdy is a below average player like you guys say he is, then wouldn't it be easy to sign him long term, way below the $300+ million number that's been thrown around? I think, just to be clear, I don't think anyone called Vladdy a below average player.
Yeah, that would be a wild accusation. Even the Vladdy haters kind of a year ago would not have said that. No, there's a below average defender. He's someone who is very one-dimensional in the value that he provides, but the value that he provides in that dimension is profound, and therefore he is an impact player. So yeah, I think that is a misunderstanding of what we're trying to say here.
Yeah, I think you're almost like intentionally mischaracterizing what that conversation was about, because I don't think anyone would say he's and no one has said that he is a below average player, period. But because you're getting two different versions of him, if you're playing him at first base, where he's like an okay defender, and when you're playing him at third base, where I think he would grade out, like you're talking about comparing him to like Matt Chapman, who won a platinum glove essentially, right? Like these are the kinds of players you're actually comparing him to. Like, you're not really comparing him to Rafael Devers' play at third base, because I don't, long term, neither of these guys are probably going to be third baseman. I think that's why it's tough to value it makes it tough to value how much additional money Vladdy would get if he is a long-term third baseman versus being a long-term first baseman. But I just can't help but think your comparison between Cabrera and the fielder situation with the Tigers is the most apt one, if only because Cabrera played both, and he still got paid a lot of money anyways. And even that, he signed that contract ages ago, and inflation would probably bring the contract for Cabrera up well into the $350 million range anyways, right? So I you're getting such an elite player offensively with the pitch recognition and the way he swings the bat speed, power, everything, that, I mean, you are going to just pay hundreds of millions of dollars, even if you have to stick him at third for like 2 years while Christian Walker is the guy at first base, for example.
Yeah, and if he grades out negatively at third, you feel really confident that the overall value he's going to provide is still going to be very, very high. But it's what they're going to learn in the next little bit, and maybe in spring training prior to 2025, is, does it reach that level of like feasibility?
Yeah.
Are we okay with throwing him out many, many starts at third base, or is it truly something that we do occasionally because they think the rest of the roster works in a particular pitching matchup? Like, we want to maximize getting X, Y, and Z player into the lineup today, so we're going to put Vladdy at third. Or is it something you can do week after week after week? And we're going to find out.
I will also find out on the other side of the break more a little bit about the Boston Red Sox and Danny Jansen's, you know, it's a new role for him in the sense he's playing on a new team, but he's going to be catching and making some history with the Boston Red Sox as he catches for both teams in the same game as this team. This game will, the first game of the doubleheader is a resumption, not a brand new game. So excited to talk about that with Alex Speer. I also want to get into some of the young guns with Alex as well. Seydan Rafaela, Willier Abreu. I know Emmanuel Valdez was just sent down, but still there's a lot of new faces in Boston these days. So going to chat about all that and more on the other side with Alex Speer. That's Nick Ashbourne. I'm Sho Ali. You're listening to and watching JSTOC Plus on Sportsnet and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to JSTOC Plus here on the Sportsnet Radio Network. You're also watching on Sportsnet Television. Sho Ali and Nick Ashbourne here with you for a couple more minutes. Last segment of the program here across the network. And we're awaiting game one of two of the doubleheader. Actually, the first of five games at Fenway Park as the Blue Jays take on the Red Sox. It will be the resumption of a game for game one. It'll start in the top of the second inning with a runner on base, and Danny Jansen will make some history as he becomes the first player to play for both teams in the same game. He'll also, in theory, catch in the same catch for the opposing team in the previous where he was previously at the plate. So it's going to be a lot of fun, I think, even if it's a bit of a weird quirk, but a fun quirk. And to help us discuss that and to certainly take a look at all things Red Sox is Alex Speer, Red Sox beat writer for the Boston Globe. Alex, how are you today?
I'm great and very much looking forward to Danny Jansen being everything, everywhere, all at once.
Yeah, I feel like in like 10 years or so, it'll be like on the next editions of Trivial Pursuit, it'll be one of the best Boston Red Sox trivia questions, Blue Jays trivia questions that you can have. But Alex, you know, I was reading a recent piece of yours for the Globe, and you used the word zombie to describe the Red Sox as they continue to defy expectations, which I love that word. It's funny, too, because I've actually used that exact word to describe the Tampa Bay Rays over the years because, like, you know, no matter what they do at the deadline, no matter who they sign or don't sign or who gets traded away or is promoted from the minors, they always seem to catch up with you. I'm curious why you feel the zombie term applies to the 2024 Boston Red Sox.
Because I think that they've been left for dead repeatedly and with good reason, right? Like they had a super unimpressive offseason. They made one major free agent acquisition. That was Lucas Giolito. He was lost for the season in the middle of spring training and had to get the UCL brace surgery. So goodbye rotation depth, right? And then shortly after that, Garrett Whitlock early in the season ended up requiring season ending surgery. So they surely didn't have the depth to withstand that. They lost Trevor Story for what we thought at the time was going to be the season very early in April. And so, you know, they did not appear to have the depth to withstand his loss at shortstop or the absence of his right-handed bat. And they dealt with a bullpen collapse after the All-Star break that led to a number of gut-wrenching losses in short order. And time after time, it's just seemed like, well, they surely can't withstand yet another woeful development in their existence, and we keep kind of burying their season, and yet they keep coming from coming out of the ground and kind of stubbornly stomping forward and pushing towards they just haven't relented in terms of staying at least on the fringes of the wild card race. They just suffered another major setback in getting swept by the Diamondbacks at home. The Red Sox have been terrible at Fenway throughout the course of this season. And so now, once again, their season is being characterized as being kind of on the brink. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see whether or not the Zombies once again go stampeding through the city.
Alex, earlier in the program, we talked a lot about playoff odds and which teams maybe are better or worse than their odds reflect. As we speak to you today, the Red Sox, according to Fangraphs at least, have a 24.5% chance of making the playoffs, or at least that's what their model says. Do you think that's a number that overstates or understates where the Red Sox are at now? And if you had to put a number on yourself, what would that look like?
I think I want to be very clear. I've been wrong left and right about the Red Sox in their likelihood of reaching the postseason throughout this season. I would still say that slightly overstates what their odds probably are, given the state of their pitching staff and some of the, you know, they do not have the same pitching depth that some of the other contenders do. And also just it's a massive lead that both the Twins and the Royals have in that race for the second and third wildcard spot right now. But that said, you know, I think I am somewhat skeptical of the idea of there being a 1-in-4 chance. But it should be pointed out that the Royals have a very, very tough schedule ahead of them. The Red Sox, you know, whether it's the Blue Jays, who have been sellers this year, right, as well as the Tigers, another team that sold at the deadline, both of those teams are on their dance card in the not-too-distant future. They still have a few games against the White Sox as they pursue their own form of ignominious history. So there's reason why it's not a zero at this point, but the Red Sox are in trouble unless they can kind of start getting on the board very quickly against the Blue Jays over the course of these next 5 games.
You know, I often say when we discuss some of the individual players on the Red Sox, I often say for the Blue Jays, Alex, that There's not enough superlatives you can lavish on Vladimir Guerrero Jr. this season because he's been so good. I feel like I could just replace Vladimir Guerrero Jr. with Rafael Devers in that sentence, and it would be equally true. When you look at Rafael Devers and what he has been doing, I mean, certainly since he signed the extension last January, but just overall, I mean, he has been one of the most lethal players in all of Major League Baseball. And I know there was some consternation prior to January 2023 if they would pony up and give him the big deal. They obviously did. But when you look at Devers night in and night out, I mean, I feel like it's without a doubt obvious to say that you're looking at one of the more special players in Major League Baseball and someone who's going to be under contract in Boston for a long time to come.
Well, the funny thing is that, you know, Devers in many ways is like the left-handed version of Vladimir Guerrero Jr.'s dad, right? Like the way that he, like his kind of ridiculous ability to take pitches that are out of the strike zone and drive them over the fence is matched by no active player. He's able to expand the strike zone, swing at pitchers' pitches, and still drive them out of the park, which is utterly infuriating for opposing teams as they try to game plan for how to attack him. I would say it's also a very interesting pairing of two players because, you know, I think that because both of them were so good at such young ages and making their major league debuts, and you know, when they were 20, when a lot of guys are still years away, the expectations for greatness have always followed them and made it sometimes difficult for them to appreciate what they've actually done in their careers, right? Like, because, you know, save for 2021 and maybe the last month and a half, I feel like, you know, everyone is always waiting for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. to be more than what he is. And, you know, it's difficult for him to sustain the level of expectation. It was interesting. I talked to Danny Jansen about that actually recently, just about who he sees Guerrero being. And he was kind of over the top in his praise for a player who is still young and yet has a consistency of routines and approach that allows him to be a potentially generational talent as a hitter. You know, what he's accomplished in his career as a 25-year-old is absurd. What Rafael Devers is accomplishing, getting to 200 homers as a 27-year-old, likewise absurd. These are great players who are sometimes difficult to appreciate their excellence.
It's funny you bring up the 200 homer plateau because for Devers, he becomes the first player in the history of the Boston Red Sox to hit 200 homers before he turns 28. And I know he turns 28 essentially in October, but I still think that is pretty crazy to say out loud, given that the Red Sox have existed for as long as they have. Like, it's one thing to say that about, you know, like an expansion franchise, for example, but for a team that is as storied as the Red Sox, that Devers has become the first guy to hit 200 home runs before he hits 28 years of age, I got to say is pretty special.
It is. All of that deserves a little bit of a caveat because Ted Williams was fighting in World War II for 4 years. So that was a real impediment to his show of power from 1942 through 1945. But it is incredible when you think about the rich history of the Red Sox and particularly the rich slugging tradition, right? Like when you think about a Hall of Famer like Jim Rice, who was in the Rookie of the Year mix when he came up in 1975 and still wasn't as fast to 200 homers, even as he won an MVP as a 24-year-old in 1978 and was a preeminent slugger, although he was probably hindered in that regard by the strike of 1981. So there's some caveats that belong in here, but Devers is a fantastic power hitter. He has been since his first days in the big leagues when he showed up and hit a homer to dead center off of King Felix in Seattle as a 20-year-old kid in the middle of the 2017 playoff race. Again, like the fact that he showed up to the big leagues with the ability to drive the ball with carry rather than being someone who would need to develop strength in order to be able to drive the ball out of the park, it is pretty remarkable.
You mentioned that you had a conversation with Danny Jansen about Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and that he had given you some good insight there. I think a lot of people in Blue Jays land would be wondering what the sort of first impression on Jansen has been, both from a, you know, fan base perspective, but also in terms of how dealing with him from a media standpoint, because I know that when he was here, he always had a good reputation in that regard. What is, the first impression on Danny Jansen as a Boston Red Sox?
Well, the first impression of him, I think, today is going to be a pretty big one. I think that, the fact that he's making history by having gone from, you know, the at bat against the Blue as a member of the Blue Jays to catching against himself, quote unquote, is a big one. But he's been nothing but professional, nothing but pleasant to interact with, someone who is viewed as, you know, as being like a veteran, a calming veteran who pitchers have quickly developed quite a bit of trust in. It's been interesting to watch how comfortable the Sox have been having him catch anyone on their staff, and particularly those who thrive by working at the bottom of the strike zone, like Tanner Houck and like Brian Baio. So I think that he's shown solid work behind the plate. I think that, you know, offensively, he's had a couple of really good at-bats in critical moments, but the production hasn't exactly been outrageous since he came over from the Blue Jays. But, you know, kind of solid professional, valued member of the roster has been the initial impression.
We're chatting with the Boston Globe's Alex Speer here on Jays Talk Plus. Show and Nick here with you until the top of the hour. Game one of two starts just after 2 p.m. Eastern on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet. Alex, I did want to ask you a little bit about some of the younger players for the Boston Red Sox, guys that have gotten their first, I guess, extended taste of Major League action this season in Willier Abreu and Seidan Rafaela. I know Valdez is with the Major League club right this second, but a lot of younger faces for the Red Sox, Tristan Casas recently, again, relatively being the operative word, being called back up off the 60-day IL. So you have a lot of younger guys making hay for the Red Sox these days, and especially on Rafaela and Abreu. I'm curious, when you look at them, what you see in terms of their long-term stature as Major League players, because in the short term, at the very least, I've been pretty impressed.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So Abreu has come to the big leagues. He's older. He's 25 now, and he has come to the big leagues with a very polished offensive approach that's made him kind of a top half of the order contributor right away. Very impressive overall player. I think that the gap between present and ceiling is not that huge, right? Like, because he has the advanced approach he does, because he's probably not going to be able to add on that much more strength than what he already features. Like, this is kind of the player that he is. That's a really good player. He's posting an OPS above 800 as a rookie. He's one of the top OPS guys in all of Major League Baseball among rookies. So that is a really good left-handed bat. We haven't seen him with a lot of left-on-left at-bats thus far. They've been managing him in a strict platoon role, but this is a quality Major League contributor. Seidan Rafaela is a guy where there is some kind of imagination about what he can be versus what he is now, even though what he is now is awfully impressive. Defensively in center field, he's already elite. He's someone who, if you were to stick him in center field right now, he would probably be in the mix for the Gold Glove among center fielders. However, because of the Trevor Story injury that I mentioned earlier, the Red Sox were desperate to have a stabilizing shortstop. And Rafaela is someone who had come up initially through the minors as a shortstop, and so they moved him back into that role. Not every day. They've still had him shuffling somewhat between short and center field, but he's done a lot of both. He's kind of split time with 60-plus games at both positions, which is a ridiculously rare feat. There just aren't a lot of guys who are that versatile for the two most demanding field positions outside of catcher. And he's shown at shortstop he has not been as polished as he is in center. So he's combined the ability to make plus defensive plays, like do the spectacular, with inconsistency, with kind of more routine aspects of that. If you were to stick him at shortstop every day for a full season, you might get a guy, or for a couple of years anyway, you might get a guy who would then compete to be a Gold Glover at shortstop. He's not there yet because of the inconsistency and youth, but the fact that he's been able to be serviceable at that position has had a huge impact overall on the Sox. And then he also has a very unrefined offensive approach where he swings at pitches that are well outside of the strike zone, sometimes makes contact with them. He has a lot of juice in his swing for a guy who's 5'9" and like 180 pounds, and surprising ability to drive the ball. So he's a fun player to watch. There's electricity, there's inconsistency. You don't know what version of Seidan Rafaela you're going to get on a given basis, but he is becoming more consistent as he makes it through his rookie season as a 24-year-old.
One refrain you hear around the Blue Jays a lot, and I'm wondering if it applies to the Red Sox, is that you know, the Yankees are so good right now, and the Baltimore Orioles have so many good young players that it's going to be really hard to break through that ceiling and really compete for the division in the years to come, even if some of the young players they brought in come through. Is that the same idea in Boston, or is the strength of the young players' performance right now enough that people are feeling optimistic about the future and them joining the top tier of the AL East?
Yeah, I think that they are in a different position than the Blue Jays, right? Like, in, if you look, you know, just at how the industry values, assesses the Blue Jays farm system, there's kind of a dearth of top level talent at the top of the system, in the upper levels, as opposed to the Red Sox, where not only do they have this young core that's performing really well at the big league level, but they also have four guys who rank in the top 100 in minor league baseball, and probably in the top 50 in some cases. They, maybe three guys who are going to land in the top 25 by the end of this year, all of whom are in AAA. So they have a they have four guys: Marcelo Meyer, who's a shortstop, although he's injured and probably out for the rest of this year. Roman Anthony, who is a who's a 20-year-old outfielder who hits the ball insanely hard. Christian Campbell, who's kind of an out of nowhere guy, who was a 2023 fourth round pick, who's exploded onto the scene and has had basically the best season in the minors this year. And then Kyle Teal, who's a catcher who was drafted out of the University of Virginia in 2023. All four of those guys look like they have a chance to contribute in the big leagues within the next year. And so that gives the Red Sox reason to believe that that their young talent base maybe isn't that far behind, especially the Orioles, right? Like, I think that the Orioles are in a separate class in terms of their young talent base than anyone else in the division, with the Rays probably a little bit behind them, and then the Yankees in a separate class, but still impressive in terms of what they have as just established big league stars, right? So I think that the Red Sox probably need to supplement that with some bold moves to add talent from outside of the organization, particularly on the pitching side. But they have the depth of prospects both to supplement what they have in the big leagues right now and to make additional trades, or to go out and say, or the money to sign free agents if they choose to go that path.
Alex, we're going to let you run, man. We appreciate you doing this for us. Thank you so much. We look forward to reading the rest of your coverage for the Globe, and best of luck covering what will, I'm sure, be an odd but fun start to this game today.
Enjoy Danny Jansen Day.
See you, man. There he goes. Alex Speer, Red Sox beat writer for the Boston Globe. Actually, speaking of Danny Jansen, Nick, you know, I think we're going to be talking about this basically up until, I don't want to call it first pitch because it's not technically, but I did want to talk about this a little bit more when it comes to the oddity that is Danny Jansen and what it is we're going to see with him catching, like Alex said, catching against himself, quote unquote, and catching for both teams in the same game. Here's Jano talking about it when asked.
Yeah, and definitely cool. You know, definitely grateful for the opportunity to be in that position. One of those, you know, crazy things about this game, and definitely an oddity. But it's going to be cool.
Is it a certain amount of let's do this and be able to move on and get back to playing baseball and not being in the middle of something like that?
I mean, maybe. Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely going to enjoy it. Definitely going to enjoy it. But then I'm sure after the initial PA announcement or the first at bat, then just get back down to baseball, and it would be like I said, it would be cool. It would be definitely be cool. But yeah, once it's done, you know, just gonna keep playing.
So there you go. That's Jano chatting with Nesson about the oddity that is him catching for both teams in the same game. Like I said, probably gonna be a pretty fun trivia question in the not too distant future. But it's funny, if you look, Nick, at the guys who are not gonna play for the Blue Jays in this game, here was the starting lineup for this game. All right. Bo Bichette was batting leadoff. He was at shortstop. Spencer Horwitz was batting second. He was at second base. Vladdy was at first base. Justin Turner was DHing. George Springer was in right field. David Schneider was in left field. He had walked, so David Schneider's going to be on base, I guess, unless they pinch run him, I guess. Danny Jansen was at the plate when the game got suspended. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa was on deck, and in the hole was Kevin Kiermaier. So you got, let's see, one, two, three, four, five guys that are not going to play in this game. So there, I can only imagine, like, when you open up MLB.com and you look at the game day picture, it's just going to be have a whole bunch of substitutions, essentially, more or less immediately.
Yeah, it's going to be tough to visually scan that box score. You know what? We talked about it earlier in the show, right? The Toronto Blue Jays in 2024 have had two different baseball teams. They had an underperforming team of veterans, most of whom they shipped away, in most cases, for kind of okay returns. You know, like, I think they did okay at the deadline, but you know, you just weren't going to get a lot for the Justin Turners of the world. You know, even Danny Jansen, again, some half decent prospects, but not blue chippers or anything like that. And then now they have this new chapter of the season, which is them running out all these young players and having these lineups where no one's older than 26 and all that. And so, yeah, the version of the Blue Jays that's going to play, I would say, not the second half of the game, the vast majority of this suspended game is very different. And I would say probably more exciting and entertaining version of the Toronto Blue Jays.
I think, too, when we talk about what to expect in this game, initially, the starter of this game was Yariel Rodriguez. He is not going to pitch in today's game. It sounds like he's actually going to pitch tomorrow. So I guess in theory, Y-Rod will have pitched on consecutive days and will have started consecutive games, I guess, is actually the more apt way to say it. But Jose Berríos, there was some talk that Berríos was actually going to come in a, again, using air quotes here, relief appearance for the bulk of this game. But it looks like, according to Dan Shulman, the Jays pivoted yesterday. So Berríos is actually going to start game two of the doubleheader today, and that Ryan Burr and Ryan Yarbrough will factor in quite heavily, much like they did in the first game against the Angels on Thursday when they had the pseudo bullpen day. But Ryan Burr is going to, again, quote unquote, start game one in this resumption in the top of the second inning. And then Ryan Yarbrough, rubber arm Yarbs, as they have referred to him, Nick, is going to try and lull Red Sox batters to sleep after Ryan Burr.
Yeah, I mean, Jose Berríos only had one relief outing in his entire career. I believe that came in 2017. So I don't think it would have been a massive change to his, you know, his routine or anything like that. He pretty much would have been like coming out and starting a game. I doubt that was a consideration. But, you know, getting this opener bulk man setup seems to fit more with resuming a game in the second inning.
It is kind of funny for Yarbrough, because Yarbrough, I think, for years, Blue Jays fans know quite well with his time with the Rays. Just like, again, I use the term lull people to sleep. We've seen a lot of that from Ryan Yarbrough. He did it against the Angels, and I'm curious to see how long Ryan Yarbrough goes out there and does his thing against the Red Sox today, Nick.
He's been surprisingly effective this season, even when he was in Los Angeles as well. Considering the stuff he puts out there, you would not expect him to perform the way he's done.
Nick, this was fun, man. Our maiden voyage on TV together. We've done it before many times on radio, but fun to do it with you on Jays Talk Plus. We're back the rest of the week, or at least on Tuesday and Wednesday before Blake returns on Thursday.
Yeah, looking forward to getting back at it tomorrow.
That is Nick Ashbourne. I'm Sho Ali. Before we go, a reminder that if you want to watch today's doubleheader, Game 1 starts just after 2 p.m. Eastern on Sportsnet and the Sportsnet Radio Network. On the radio, Ben Shulman and Chris LaRue have the call on the network for both games. Dan Shulman, of course, will be on TV. Thanks to all of our guests, John Becker and Alex Spear. Thanks to Jen Rolnick, to Austin Mackey, to Amit Mann. For Nick, I'm Sho. We're back tomorrow with more Jays Talk Plus. Talk to you later.